This is not a drill. This is not a drill. General quarters. General quarters. All hands on your battle station.
Welcome to Midrats with Sal from Commander Salamander and Eagle One from Eagle Speak at Sea or Shore, your home for a discussion of national security issues and all things maritime. And welcome aboard, everybody. I am the aforementioned Sal, along with my co-host, the ever-genial Eagle One of Eagle Speak. We really appreciate you taking time today to join us for another edition of Midrats. And as a reminder to those that are joining us live, you can scroll down to the bottom of the show page. That's where you will find the chat room with the usual suspects. That's a great place if you have an observation you'd like to make during the course of the show, or if there is a question you would like for us to direct towards our guests, and it doesn't look like we're heading that direction, that's a great place to put it, because we'll be monitoring that during the course of the show, and we're more than happy to steal your questions if they're better than ours. Also, if you have to leave halfway through the show to go watch Chapel Hill play Virginia Tech or any other sports games and you want to see what you missed, if you don't subscribe to the free podcast over at iTunes, you can always go back over to Blog Talk Radio and grab the full archive there. Enough of that, though. Let's go ahead and get on with the show. And today's topic, we're going to look at whether we are making our best efforts and heading in the right direction to get the combat integration of women right. Now that we've gone from the if with the developments in the last few months, we really need to focus on how. With an apparent broad disconnect between the biological realities of men and women, cultural norms, the political desires of our civilian leadership, and also look at what is the right way to make sure that we give those who want to make the run to take advantage of certain warfare specialties, that they're given a fair chance to do so, but also that the greater needs of the service and combat capability is maintained as well. And our guest to come on today, we're really looking forward to having her, really, and I think an ideal guest to talk about for the full hour will be Lieutenant Colonel Kate Germano, USMC. Kate was commissioned back in 1996 and has served for over 19 years on active duty with the United States Marine Corps. And she still is here serving on active duty, but she is on as just Kate today. So I'll go ahead and save her the effort of having to put out the disclaimer there. The views she speaks today are strictly hers and not that of the United States Marine Corps. She is a combat veteran, and she has additionally participated in numerous operational and humanitarian assistance and disaster relief deployments. Ashore, her duties have also included the Marine aid to the Secretary of the Navy. She was selected for command twice. Most recently, she was the commanding officer of the Marine Corps' only all-female unit, the 4th Recruit Training Battalion. She holds a bachelor's degree from Goucher College, where she majored in history with a pre-law emphasis. And back in 2011, she graduated with distinction from the Marine Corps Command and Staff College, earning a master's degree in military science. She is actively engaged in the struggle to end gender bias in the military, and she is a vocal proponent for equal rights and the elimination of double standards and lowered expectations for female conduct and performance. Kate, welcome to Midrats.
Thank you so much for having me. It's great to be here.
Really looking forward to the next hour. And I know a lot of our listeners are familiar with your background, but we have a pretty diverse audience, and many may not. So just kind of kick things off here and to set the table. Many times topics, you don't get to choose the topic that everybody wants to talk to you about. Sometimes those topics pick you. And until events of the last few months and year took place, you had been your standard issue Marine Corps Lieutenant Colonel, taking care of your Marines and taking charge and carry out the plan of the day. But in the last few months especially, you and I would say one of our former Midrats guests as well, Jeanette Haney, and others have really started to engage in the conversation about gender integration and how to get it right. For our listeners, if you could, just kind of give us the background on why this came to be a topic that really floated up in the public sphere, having you as somebody who's carrying on the conversation?
Sure. I really appreciate you allowing me to be on the show to talk about this issue. As you probably know from reading articles online and just in the media in general, gender equality can be a really divisive topic, and that's especially true for the Marine Corps, I think, because the gender lines have been pretty well divided in the sand, laid out in the sand. And so really where I came in the discussion, unfortunately for me, I think, is that when I got down to Parris Island, it is the only place in the DOD, in the military in general, where women are trained separately from men. And so I had my own sort of expectations for what I would find when I got down there, but the reality of what I experienced really was what propelled me to the fore in terms of being a gender equality advocate. I mean, what I saw when I got down there as the commanding officer of 4th Battalion was that the women were in segregated training, and the Marine Corps' sort of their background and their justification for why the Marine Corps has segregated training for women on the enlisted side was that it allowed them to develop confidence because they were being trained by women in an all-women environment. And so I thought that was a little bit odd because in the rest of the Marine Corps, as you know, women are the minority. And so I had gone through my whole career being the one woman in, 50 in a unit and never really thinking that was odd, just thinking it was more of an opportunity than anything else. So when I got down to Parris Island, I was a little bit taken aback by the fact that it was still segregated, but I was willing to allow the Marine Corps' justification to sort of become my reality as long as that came with the results that were expected. And unfortunately, almost from the first training event that I observed, I saw that segregation really allowed women to become an afterthought in training, and it allowed females to develop a historical record of underperforming compared to their male counterparts because there was very little attention paid to them, both by the leadership and then internal to 4th Battalion. We had just sort of accepted for decades that women would do less, and that became the norm. And so I'm here today, having been the former commanding officer of 4th Recruit Training Battalion, primarily because I saw that there was a significant delta between the performance of male recruits and female recruits. And when I started sort of pulling the string on why that would be, what I found was that it was mainly because of the way that we had conducted training in a segregated fashion, and then it was also because there was gender bias. So I became a very outspoken proponent of change, and that was unsettling to the leadership, and so I ended up getting fired as a result.
Well, that's never a help. Let me approach this a little bit backwards. Does the Marine Corps have currently in jobs, aviation, artillery, tankers? Is the only place that the integration has not taken place yet in the infantry?
It's ground combat jobs in general. Up until this past year, there were no women in any ground combat jobs or units below the regimental level, and absolutely none had those MOSs. And so my tenure at 4th Battalion came on the heels, or just ahead of, I should say, the historic change to the roles that women were allowed to perform in the Marine Corps. And so that was one of the reasons that I developed this idea that if we're really going to change the way women are perceived and how qualified they are for those positions that just opened up, then we need to take a look at changing how we do initial training and how we recruit them.
Well, I think one of the stories, I know one of the concerns as a leader that you brought out, and when I first read it, I was kind of set back that you were the first one to bring it up, because I know that if I was in your shoes, I would have as well, is many times perceptions become realities. And when people see things a certain way, it either confirms a previous held bias or can create one where one didn't exist before. And I think you outlined a little bit how with the segregation that led to lower expectations. And I thought one of the great examples of that kind of set that mindset were the chairs. The chairs at the end of the march. Talk for a little bit about what those chairs are, why they were only located in one spot, and how you saw that as something that was worth pushing back against.
Absolutely. So this was really one of the first times I observed bias on the depot. My first crucible hike, the crucible, for anyone who doesn't know and isn't familiar with recruit training, it's the culminating event for recruit training. For recruits, they are sent out to the field for 2 days with very little food, very little sleep. And then the final event before they earn their Eagle, Globe, and Anchor at this very emotional ceremony on the parade deck is a nine-mile hike. And so the first hike that I went on, I'd been on hikes throughout my Marine Corps career, but the first hike that I went on with 4th Battalion, what I found was that we weren't marching the full nine-mile hike. And then at the stops where we would take breaks to go to the restroom and refill canteens, I kept seeing these lines of female recruits going towards the van. And when I asked the drill instructor sort of, you know, what was going on, I was told, well, they feel like they can't finish the hike. So in my mind, I'm thinking, you know, this is the culminating event for all recruits. In other words, you have to earn the title, and this is the final way that you demonstrate that you're ready for the obligations that come with that Eagle, Globe, and Anchor. So I took that on board, and I thought that was odd. And then we got to the end of the hike, and I noticed that we had not marched the full 9 miles. And then I noticed that at the parade deck, where the male company is lined up in formation and then the females are off to the side, there was a row of chairs that was set up behind the females, just sitting there. And so I pulled one of the drill instructors or one of my company commanders aside, and I asked about the chairs. And they said, oh, yeah, we always set those up in case the recruits are too tired to stand. And I thought, wow. First, as you said, the perspective of a male recruit seeing this line of chairs behind the females would automatically create the perception that women can't hang and that somehow recruit training is easier. But second, it appeared to me that the females who were part of 4th Battalion as drill instructors and officers, that they had become so used to that type of thing that it didn't even occur to them that that would be bad and considered derogatory for females. And so that was really the first thing that I changed, is I did away with the chairs. And it made a lot of people concerned and anxious, because they were afraid that if I took the chairs away, the females would fall out of the formation. And lo and behold, they didn't. So the chairs were sort of the first symbolic way to do away with the gender bias on the depot that's existed for so long. But really, the predominant example has to do with the rifle range. When I became the commanding officer of the 4th Battalion, you know, one of the things that a battalion commander wants to do is improve the unit and leave it in better shape than it was when they took over. And so I started looking at ways where we could start improving the caliber of Marine that we were making in our battalion. And to do that, I had to find some sort of data to let me know sort of the baseline for how we had been performing. And the data covered everything, all of the graduation events from academics, physical fitness, the practical application exam, and then the rifle range. And when I looked at that data in black and white, and it covered many, many years, what I saw blew me away, literally blew me away, because we have a slogan in the Marine Corps, and probably all of the folks out there have heard it, and that is every Marine a rifleman. Doesn't say every male Marine a rifleman. It says every Marine is a rifleman. So when I looked at the rifle range data, what I saw was that for decades, women had been really shooting so subpar that a full third of each cohort would have to be dropped back in training because they had gone unqualified, which meant that it affected their confidence in handling their weapons, and it also took valuable training time and resources away from the Marine Corps. And so really, focusing on improving the caliber of a recruit didn't start with the chairs as much as it started with changing how we were training recruits to shoot on the rifle range to make them more competitive with their male counterparts. That was very important to me.
How much of what you face in this process is the process is the problem of recruiting the right people. Are some of these people, that women that come into the Marine Corps, are they happy? I want to use this carefully. Are they satisfied with the low expectations? Is that mean we're recruiting the wrong person, or is it generally they just don't know any different, or are they very? Is it a matter of them being unhappy?
Yeah, you know, that's a really good question. I think it's two things. One, I think that some of the graduation requirements have nothing to do with gender. So there are certain areas, such as physical fitness, where I think we're not recruiting the highest caliber recruit that we possibly can. And I can talk more about that in a minute. But I would say, first and foremost, this is a language expectancy issue. You know, you talked about developing a perception and developing sort of an idea of where women fall out in the Marine Corps just based on where we've been. And where we've been comes from language expectancy. So what we found when we started peeling back the layers of the onion for the rifle range, for example, was that the male coaches were convinced that the females couldn't shoot because for decades the females weren't performing. And so it becomes almost a self-licking ice cream cone because the male recruits see no incentive in working harder, or the male coaches, excuse me, see no incentive in working harder to get the females to shoot well because they believe it can't be done because the women in the past have not done well. And so changing the language expectancy with the coaches was, number one, the most important thing that we had to do from the get-go. And then the second thing that was important in changing the perspective about women on the range and what we could accomplish was getting the female drill instructors to understand that it wasn't acceptable for the females to be expected to do less. The recruits had no idea. So your question was basically, is it that the, you know, we're recruiting the wrong person? Well, the recruits only know what they know. But when they're only training in a segregated battalion and for decades no one's really paid attention to the scores, everyone becomes complacent. So the recruits don't know that they're underperforming because the drill instructors aren't pushing them to excel, and that's because they've accepted the complacency. It's just, it's part of that environment. Does that make sense?
Oh, perfectly, yeah.
The soft bigotry of low expectations, so to speak. That kind of leads into the next question that I wanted to broach with you, because as kind of I said in the intro, there are certain biological differences between men and women, and
sure.
I say this as somebody, I'm a ROTC guy, and there was a female in our class who got married right after graduation and still are married. She stayed on active duty. He went USNR and became he works, but he really supports her career. But anyway, she would consistently do more push-ups than I did and could do more sit-ups than I could. Part of it was she was a great athlete. The other part of it was I was a little bit of a slug. But there's a certain trade-off between quantity and quality. And
yes.
Correct me if I'm the way I perceive you go, you are for the quality. It's much better to have three Marines that happen to be female who have met the same qualifications than have 10 women wearing Marine Corps uniforms, of which maybe three are okay and the other seven are not. And there's a quote from an article that you had come out here last month. And I just wanted to quote you back at you here for a second for our listeners, beginning a quote. This is an historic opportunity for the Marine Corps to fundamentally improve how we indoctrinate men and women into our culture and at recruit training. Senior leaders today have an unprecedented opportunity to fully leverage the talent base of drill instructors and junior officers while ensuring all recruits are held to the same high standards for performance regardless of gender, end quote. If we were able to take that route, you would get quality, physical quality at least, at a lower quantity, but there seems to be a big push, mostly inside the area that has 2 feet of snow plus around the D.C. Beltway right now. They're interested in, I'll use the Q word, they're interested in quotas. They want this many as a percentage, and they want each in here. And you there's a trade-off there. How comfortable are you with the connect or the disconnect between those that are pushing for defined quotas versus the very real reality you as a recruit commander saw of the very limited pool that you're going to be able to pull in an all-volunteer force?
Well, you know, I think that's a misnomer. I think that it is a perception, a widely held belief that we're not going to be able to increase the number of women who we want to join while also increasing the quality. And I say that it's a commonly held misperception because I have two tours on recruiting duty in my career, and I was the commanding officer of a recruiting station, one of the largest in the nation. I was also the operations officer and executive officer for another very large recruiting station. And I do have a focus on quantity and quality, and I think you can achieve both. But I think it starts with focusing on high-caliber applicants from the beginning. And it can be done. I mean, I saw that when I was a commanding officer. It takes changing the mindset of the people who are recruiting and telling them what's in it for them if they recruit high-caliber applicants. And that's for males and females. I can tell you that my Marines achieved the lowest attrition rate on the recruit depot. The kids we were shipping to boot camp, we had the lowest attrition rate at boot camp that had ever been achieved in the nation. And it came from, once again, telling them up front what was in it for them if we changed our focus from quantity over quality, and then really then trying to convince the Marine Corps that it was a good thing for the Marine Corps that we continue that. So in the end, what we found was that we could do both. We could raise the standards for male and female applicants and then demand more of them in terms of their preparation before going to recruit training and get better results in the end. So I don't think it's a, you know, you have to do this to get this and you can only get this if you do this. I think it's essentially you can do both, but the first thing we have to do is accept that for decades we've had lower expectations for women and we need to demand more from them.
Well, how do we recruit the numbers of better quality? And you mentioned something for a second I've read about before, and I wonder if you could flesh it out for the listener. You talked
sure.
about preparation prior to going to boot camp. That can also move the needle. Could you talk about that for a second?
Absolutely. So there's a program called the Delayed Entry Program, and essentially what it allows an applicant to do is take up to a year from the time that they swear in at the military entrance processing facility to the time that they actually go to recruit training. And the recruiter's role in that time frame is to lay out expectations for each applicant to achieve before they can be found mentally and physically prepared to go to training. So the most interesting thing about that is both when I took over a station as a commander and then when I got to 4th Battalion, what I found was that the vast majority of our women were coming to training without having been held accountable by their recruiters for making the progress that they should have. And so what we were seeing was a large number of mental health discharges drastically outnumbered the male battalions and the male recruits. But we also saw a larger number of females who were broken during training. And those same females were the ones who, when we took the data and we traced sort of where they were when they came to recruit training in terms of their physical fitness, what we found was they were running a 13 minute 30 second mile and a half or worse, and that was really the linchpin. If you were coming to recruit training and you were running that slow, it made you so much more likely to be a discharge or a drop for a physical reason, a medical reason. And so I saw both when I was on recruiting and then when I was on the depot how important that physical fitness is. Physical fitness makes you mentally tough, and it makes you physically tough. And if you have that resiliency before you get to recruit training, you're going to succeed because it's not going to be the first time that you've ever been challenged.
Well, yeah, but we get to the question. I think maybe you already answered this, but part of the thing we've seen with firefighters and other physically challenging jobs is that sometimes the quota, I think, which Commander Salamander was talking about earlier, tends to drive the problem. Instead of saying, here is a common standard that everybody has to meet this minimum, we've seen the cases where some fire departments, for example, have lowered the standard for women. Is that an issue that would concern you? Should there be some minimum standard that everybody across the board, whatever race, gender, national origin, all that stuff has to meet?
I think we do need gender-neutral standards, but I think that's really the second step. I think the first step in fixing this issue for the Marine Corps really has to do with recruiting, because we say we recruit women. That's really a misnomer. We allow women to come into the office when they have failed out of college. Generally, the women who are coming into the Marine Corps are 1 to 2 years older than their peers, their male applicants. They've tried a year or two of college and they've either flunked out or decided it's not for them, or they're running from personal or family situations and they're looking for just to get out of town. And anyone who has been to recruit training can tell you those are not the best reasons to join the Marine Corps, and they're certainly not the reasons that are going to keep you focused and engaged in training. And so it's not as much about the quota issue as it is about the fact that we're not going out and actively seeking high-quality, physically fit, mentally tough applicants. And one of the ways that we do that for the males is we focus on the high school market. Male recruiters, female recruiters, they are absolutely required to go into the high schools and do class talks, to visit sports teams. But they do that for the males. There's been so little attention and accountability paid to how we recruit women and who is coming in that we've become sort of an afterthought. So the women who walk into the office, they become the women we enlist because we don't have to go out and work hard to find high-caliber applicants.
And this sounds a little parochial, but I don't think it is. Because I try to look at the broad spectrum of military issues. But it seems, especially when it comes to gender integration, and really both sides of the discussion, those that want to keep certain jobs in combat areas segregated and those that believe in full integration, a lot of this conversation is coming from Marine Corps officers from the four-star level down to platoon sergeants and everything in between.
Mm-hmm.
But we really don't see the same level of discussion on either side from Army or the Air Force or the Navy. Is there something intrinsically different about Marine Corps requirements, Marine Corps culture, or Marine Corps experience in gender integration up to this point that you think is a cause of why the Marines out of proportion to their overall size relative to the rest of the military service have been so engaged in this conversation?
You know, I love the Marine Corps. It has been so good to me, and it's been good to my husband. But what I can say is that we are always the last to embrace change. We were the last to embrace segregation, and we were the last to accept that Don't Ask, Don't Tell was being repealed. And so I think that and I'm sorry, I said segregation, I meant desegregation, but I think that it's important to recognize that those issues were very emotional, a lot of the arguments were not based on facts. And I think we're seeing the same thing to a greater degree than Don't Ask, Don't Tell for gender issues. And it's unfortunate because when I read some of the really vituperative comments online pertaining to articles that have been written on how we should integrate and the importance of ending gender bias, it's embarrassing to me because, you know, on one hand, that's an emotional reaction. I got that. But on the other hand, there have been articles written that show, you know, hey, look, statistically, we have data that shows women have been allowed to underperform for decades. And the conversation never focuses on that. It never focuses on, well, gee, why is that? Or, my gosh, what could change for the better if we eliminated, you know, how we're training these women and the bias there? So I think it's cultural, absolutely, and I think it's emotional. It's unfortunate, and that's really where the leadership comes in. They're going to play a key role in making sure that platoon sergeant understands that the debate is over, the decision's been made, and now it's time to figure out the best way to move forward together.
Well, as you went through this stuff as at the recruit depot, did you find this is kind of sound odd, but did you find that your insistence that certain standards be met, if you had been a male officer, would they have looked askance at you the way they seem to have as a result of at least indicated by the results of your being, quote, fired from your job?
I can tell you point blank that, first of all, the Marine Corps' leadership traits and principles, they are not gender specific. And so for 18 years prior to getting to the recruit depot, I had exhibited all of the same traits and qualities that made my male counterparts successful. And I had always been viewed favorably in terms of how I exercised those traits and principles, really up until the time that I became a major. And that was really when I started to work with more senior people, and I realized that there is this concept of benevolent sexism at play, and it's unfortunate because it holds women back, but it also holds the institution back. So, you know, my husband's sitting here, and I'll tell you a funny story. When I, about 3 weeks before I got relieved, my sergeant major and I, we were invited to a retirement ceremony at the depot headquarters, and the Brigadier General who was in charge of the depot was the speaker for the event. And I had already been having problems with my boss at that point. I already had been having issues about how I was perceived as being too aggressive and too direct and too blunt. And during this retirement ceremony, the commanding general of the recruit depot made a comment about this guy who's retiring being this awesome officer colonel with, you know, 26 years of service, honorable, known as a go-getter and aggressive. And then he made a joke about how this guy had been called the ice pick. And the guy was known throughout the depot, according to the Brigadier General, for being, you know, going for the jugular. And so his nickname was the ice pick. So my sergeant major and I are sitting there listening to everybody kind of chuckle, and we're thinking, wow, this is crazy, because here this guy is being lauded for, you know, being this ice pick killer, and yet every day we're being told that we're leaning too far forward, we're being too aggressive, we're too this, we're too that. And so I think that, you know, in the Marine Corps especially, the culture is such that men are perceived as being tough, which means they're strong, and women who are tough are perceived as being bossy, and that's unfortunate.
While we're digging into cultures, being that you've had, I've been off to active duty for 6 years now, and people ask me on a regular basis, you know, of the many things I miss, one of them is working on a day-to-day basis with the young men and women today. I always get the hair up on the back of my neck when people insult the younger generation. Great young men and women out today. The country is secure and just fine. But when you talk about culture, and I think sometimes it's overplayed, but I think it's accurate in other areas, when you look at generational differences, in generational differences on both sides of discussion, I think some of that benign sexism that you described, you could almost call an early 1970s mindset. And I think also there are some people in the women's rights movement that also seem to be stuck in the early 1970s. A lot has happened since then. And come from the recruit depot, you worked intimately with a lot of the young women and young men, especially the 18 to 25 cohort that comes through there. How do you see a different understanding of women's full integration for the baby boomers, Gen X, who right now are the mid-grade officers and senior NCO group, and then also the younger 18 to 25 cohort? And if there is a generational disconnect that you see there, is that causing some of the clunkiness that we see as people try to get their hands around this problem?
Absolutely. I mean, you know, you hit the nail on the head when you said this is senior officers, general officer level, kind of stuck in the 1970s mindset. And the problem is that when you have general officers set policies or take a policy from SecDef and then have to enforce the policy and put it into action, the way that they do that and the way that they come across and are perceived by the junior Marines then becomes the junior Marines' perspective and reality. So let me just caveat that by saying I worked with some of the most incredible Marines, male and female. I have been so fortunate in the people that I've worked with. And the women who I worked with at 4th Battalion, 90% of them were absolutely amazing. And they, before I got there, they were working 10 times harder than they needed to for various reasons. But even with that said, they worked their behinds off to try to make the Marines, the recruits that they had, the best Marines they could be. And then when we made changes in how we were doing training, they rose to the occasion and they accomplished amazing things like raising our initial rifle qualification rate to just under 92% in less than 12 months. They were amazing. At the same time, I had a cadre of officers and senior staff NCOs who were resistant to change because it was almost an indictment of them, perceived by them, not real, that we were trying to make the recruits better because they had gone through the same recruit training, and then when they were first tour drill instructors and first tour recruit depot personnel, they were part of the problem and not the solution. These individuals, this very small group of individuals who are of the millennial generation, you know, they're part of the microaggression generation, and instead of being direct, and, you know, using the commander-to-Marine relationship properly, they, anytime they had an issue with me, they would go to my boss. And that's really, really unfortunate because we were doing some incredible things at that recruit depot. And the Marines were amazing on the whole. They were incredible. They did amazing things with very few resources, and they achieved some pretty stupendous accomplishments.
One of the concerns for people in the Marine Corps, I would think, and certainly in the Army, has been that in combat, in the infantry, we demand right now our soldiers and Marines carry huge amounts of weight, carry all kinds of equipment, live rough in the field, and there's this I think perception, especially among us older people, not me, but others, that women can't act this. Is there, you know, that they won't be able to carry the load. They won't be able to drag a 200-pound guy who's been wounded out of harm's way. How do you address that issue?
You know, what I would say is look to the Serena Williams of the world. I would say look to the CrossFit athletes, females who compete with their male counterparts on a daily basis and win the same prize money. Women have the capacity to be incredibly strong, but it doesn't come for free, and it's going to require work, and it's going to require finding individuals who have an affinity with physical fitness that they can translate into Marine Corps service, and that will be it'll be great when the Marine Corps gets to that point because this will be an issue. There will always be women who cannot carry the weight. There are men who cannot carry the weight. And if I could remind everybody, you know, Audie Murphy weighed 110 pounds when he first tried to join the service, and he was, I think, 5'8". So he wasn't the tallest guy, and he certainly wasn't the most muscular guy, but he was the most decorated soldier of World War II. So, you know, part of this is physical strength, but a lot of it is mental toughness. And we're really missing the boat on both when it comes to the majority of the females that we're enlisting.
Well, one of the other
Go ahead.
I was going to say those of us who experienced, I had a gender integrated unit when I was in the reserves, and part of it, and maybe this is paternalism, maybe this is, I'm not sure what it was, but you know, I always had trouble. We're camping out in the field. We had tents. We had and it was always uncomfortable for me to have integrate the tents, not integrate the tents. Do it by watch section or whatever. Those are simple, fundamental issues which ought to be easy to solve, but they always seem to be problematic to me. How do you address those issues?
I think that, you know, that goes back to, you may not even realize that you are uncomfortable with that as I don't want to say you're a benevolent sexist, but benevolent sexism means that there is this predominant feel that women need to be sheltered and protected, and it has no place in the military. Women join the service for the same reasons that men do, and that is basically to have a better life and to serve their country. So this idea that women need to be protected by segregating them is mistaken, because nowhere else in America have we ever seen that separate is really equal. So if women are going to be held to standards and are going to be expected to do the job just like their male counterparts, we need to get past the issue of being afraid to talk about physiology and things like, you know, menstruation and medical conditions, and we just need to accept that those are medical and physiological issues that are common to the entire human species. It shouldn't scare anybody to have women living in a tent next to men who are living in a tent. But, you know, there again, when we say that we're going to integrate, I think most people jump to the assumption that integration requires females and males to live in the same squat bay. And I think that there's a much more palatable solution and a much more effective solution out there. It just requires some work.
There's a quote in an article, and like I mentioned before, you've done some stuff with a prior Midrats guest, Jeanette Haney, and I'll just quote you again here, quote, "This isn't about women going into combat. Women have gone into combat for decades now and have excelled. This is in particular about infantry," unquote. And within living memory, the Israelis and the Soviets had a lot of experience of women performing almost all combat-related functions. And we also have a lot of our allied forces in Western Europe that also have had full gender integration in their forces. If we get outside our Navy, Marine Corps, or even USA, DOD sphere here, are there some lessons from the Israeli, the Soviet, and also from our allies that really should be at the front of our discussion as we look to make sure that we get this right?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's interesting that you mentioned that, because in December, a Marine Corps commissioned RAND study came out, and it was on best practices for integration. And one of the things that the study presented, one of the findings, was that we do have lessons to learn, positive and negative, from countries where we have integrated or they have integrated the forces. So there are lessons to be learned there. But again, I think that there's also a misperception that integration of the force means that we're absolutely going to have males and females showering together in the same squad base together. And I think that there is another solution, and I just published an article recently, an op-ed in the Marine Corps Times, that sort of talked through how it can be done in a smart way that would allow us to integrate and gender bias and also hold recruits of both sexes accountable. So there are definitely lessons to be learned. And I'll tell you this too, the main lesson learned from the RAND study is that leadership will be the most necessary component of successful integration, period.
Well, I guess my Starship Troopers view of gender integration is probably not the best model. And you know, in my defense, when I talked about the gender integrated unit, that was a long time ago, and it was kind of a new issue. And you know, when I did that, I think is, and this is something that I recommend to people, is that I talk to the people involved and said, you know, what's the best way to go about this, and let them help me work it out as best we could. But you know, we're talking about we use Serena Williams as an example of a you know, obviously a terrifically fit human being, and I used to run marathons, and I got regularly beaten by women who were much more capable of running faster than I was. But as we go forward with these gender integration things, you know, all the, and I don't think it's fair to discount completely, you know, sharing foxholes, sharing, you know, god awful bad places. How do we deal with those issues? I mean, is there a training issue there? Is it the kind of people we recruit, or is it just simply leadership and having the right people in charge?
It's leadership and accountability, period. I mean, here's the deal. we cannot afford to integrate via the Starship Trooper mechanism. We cannot afford to take that approach at the recruit training level, mainly because it's the foundational training for males and females. And there has to be some degree of mentorship from males and females for both genders of recruit. But there also has to be a little bit of separation there. I think in every other facet of the military, we have got to get rid of this concept of women as being the other. You know, when I was a second lieutenant and I stood duty for the first time at the commanding general's building in 29 Palms, I stood duty with a male staff sergeant. He was my AD. And his wife called the unit probably 50 times that night. And when I asked him, I was like, hey, is everything okay? Do you need to go home? I mean, is your wife doing okay? What it turned out to be was that she was afraid that he and I were having some sort of inappropriate relationship while we were on duty. And so part of this, as you said, is, hey, we need to not only make sure that we're looking at ourselves as leaders and we're doing this the right way, but we need to be talking to the Marines and then making sure that they are talking to their families so that there is no concern that integration will cause these issues. It's just being a leader, period.
I like how in many of your discussions you framed around, you know, three central pillars: leadership, standards, and accountability. If we could all take out our bag of fairy dust and sprinkle that on everybody's head, I think we could, you know, move this along a little better. Unfortunately, though, there seems to be a tendency to go off into to rabbit holes and distractions and attractive shiny squirrels in the corner. And yes, I'm prejudicing my question here, but I really think it is an almost gobsmacking distraction that's pulling people off from, which is the important, the direction of God has been clear this is going to happen. So let's focus on leadership, standards, and accountability. I am interested, and it's okay if you disagree with me, I'm interested in your take on what, from my point of view, is unproductive and petty, and that is the move to even take the effort, at least in the Navy, they're taking off some of our most senior enlisted personnel to absorb options and rooms together, talking about how we can remove one syllable from a lot of our job descriptions, i.e. mm-hmm. man. Is that really a productive use of our time at this stage of the operations? And how much does that ever come up in topics with your female Marines, is they're looking forward to get training going forward?
So the topic has never come up with my female Marines. However, I was initially sort of your mind thinking, gosh, you know, we haven't even tackled the issue of integrating recruit training. Why are we so focused on changing the titles? Be that as it may, one, it's the Secretary's direction. I mean, Secretary Mabus has said this is what we're going to do. Secretary of Defense is his direction, so we have to do it. Fair enough. But the other point is, as I was doing research the other day for whatever reason, I can't even remember, I came across a study that spoke to this exact issue. And essentially, the study results, the conclusions were essentially that, you know, titles do matter, and that titles, whether you mean to or not, tend to reinforce the difference between the genders, which then has an impact on how successful people are in fulfilling those roles. And so until I read the study that, you know, I just read on, I think, Thursday, I was skeptical as well, and I thought, gosh, we're spending a lot of time doing this. But I guess the Secretary of Defense and Secretary Mabus, I guess their perspective is you have to start thinking about the Marine, not the female Marine, not the, you know, it's about changing the cultural perspective. And while I think recruit training and the integration of recruit training is going to be the most important part of that, I think it does come down to the titles. So probably not the answer you wanted to hear, but ultimately, you know, my husband pointed out it's policeman versus police officer. If you don't fit the paradigm of policeman, are you less than? Are you perceived as less than? Are you perceived as being less qualified? I don't know. So.
Well, not to get into that too much, but it seems to me that if, you know, we obviously have firefighters, that's an easy switch. Some jobs mm-hmm. have always been, you know, what's a yeoman? What's a personnelman? I mean, what are you going to call them? A personnelist,
sure.
something, you know, and that's why a lot of us are a little like, you know, this is just another one of those
sure.
things that it's probably not. I mean, I agree with you. I think that I was just going to ask about that female Marine. I mean, I think what you're saying is I want a Marine to be a Marine and,
right.
you know, all Marine and not, and there shouldn't be any distinction between the two.
That's right.
Sexes. So, And along those lines, you know, there are some jobs which require, or at least as they're presently configured, require brute strength. I mean, I guess handling or, you know, 105 howitzer rounds or whatever, you know, those are heavy things. And you're saying that there are going to be women who can do that job, and some women won't be able to do that job, but there's some guys who can't do that job.
Absolutely.
Okay. Then I'm with you on that one. As you've gone through this, what's been the toughest thing for you to deal with as a result of your sudden notoriety?
Wow. Well, this has been a really challenging year for many reasons. For me, the hardest and most disheartening thing that I've experienced is that I know what my Marines and I experienced on the recruit depot. I know what my recruits were experiencing on the recruit depot. We had data to demonstrate that gender bias truly existed. We knew that individuals on the recruit depot were saying derogatory things about female Marines and female recruits. So we had all of this information, much of which was in black and white. I mean, I wasn't making this stuff up, and yet, when I look back at my relief, you know, first of all, when you're relieved as a Marine, it is the penultimate sin, particularly if the finding is that you were relieved for being abusive. And so, you know, first of all, that process in and of itself was absolutely demoralizing. But second of all, you know, I can't tell you the number of days that I still wake up and the number of moments in a day where I think to myself, my God, am I crazy? Like, am I the only one who thinks that this is a problem? Because to this day, the Marine Corps has never, ever acknowledged the existence of that data. And they've never acknowledged that the way that we've been conducting recruit training has not been putting out the types of Marines that we needed. And so what that means is that over the past 15 years, we've been engaged at war on two different fronts, but the women who've been participating in combat operations have not been confident with their weapons, have not been good shots, have potentially been putting their own lives and the lives of their fellow Marines at risk because they haven't been as good with their weapons. You know, every Marine's a rifleman. So I think, you know, one, getting fired in of itself is a terrible experience, particularly when you feel like in your heart of hearts you're doing things for the right reasons. And two, I think, you know, it's amazing how many times I still question my sanity knowing what I've seen and experienced and never having had the Marine Corps acknowledge that, you know, the data exists and we really have been not doing as well as we should have.
One thing you said early on in the show that I wanted to touch base on earlier, but I did not, before we go is, you had mentioned, you know, your experience on the front line that you said that we don't really recruit women. And vive la différence, men and women are different. And there are a lot of issues that take place when people are separated that you outlined earlier in the show that clearly are a breakout, which leads me to, you know, the intake. What do we need to do at the intake? What are those particular types of women, what is their particular background, mindset that would, if we concentrated recruiting in that particular area and those particular backgrounds, would lead us to a better result on the far end once they get into the fleet and stay in, reenlist, or have to leave? Where do you think we could focus better on the intake to get the right women in to be able to perform the way that we want them to?
Well, first and foremost, I think it goes back to being in the high schools and making sure that your high school seniors are predominantly your market, and that your focus with your high school seniors is on talking to sports teams and kids who are, on the honor roll and kids who are part of extracurricular activities. Those kids have already demonstrated that they have the mental and physical toughness to get through recruit training. I would also say that, kids who participate in extracurricular activities already have social skills, which makes being in a recruit training very stressful environment, and building that team makes it so much easier. So I think that's first and foremost where we need to focus. But then, just as important is looking at how we are screening young women for previous mental health issues. So, for example, at least 50% of all of the discharges for women on the Recruit Depot are for mental health reasons. Marine Corps has the highest percentage of sexual assaults. And if you look at, the fact that 70% of victims of sexual assault will be re-victimized, essentially what that means is we're enlisting a large number of young women who come from that type of background. It doesn't mean that they should be disqualified up front, but what it does mean is that there's a little bit of screening, or a lot of screening, that needs to take place at the recruiter level and at the commanding officer level to make sure that those girls have demonstrated the resiliency necessary to be successful as Marines, because not all of them do. And so I think if you focus on the recruiting audience and then you focus on improving your screening and making it more stringent, I think the Marine Corps could be highly successful.
One of the most controversial studies recently was of combat units that were gender integrated. They allegedly didn't perform as well as the all male units. Can you discuss that a little bit? Was that a valuable study, or is that an invalid study?
Well, I think if you consider that the women who participated in that study were all sort of the beneficiaries, if you will, of the lesser training when they went through boot camp, I think it would make sense that they didn't perform up to the level of the males, both on the rifle ranges and from a physical fitness perspective. So I think that the study in and of itself has some value, but I would say that if you look at who the participants were, they weren't going to be competitive with the males on the study because of where they were trained initially.
Well, that does make sense on the intake and exhaust. And Kate, as we come near the end of the show, I know you're still on active duty, and this is an ongoing conversation with you. And I've seen you've partnered, you've done other interviews. I think with a lot of things that have happened over the course of the last couple of months, there's going to be an ongoing discussion here to try to make sure that the different iterations we go through, that we do our best to get it right. Along those lines, what do you have any other things planned in the work here, or do you plan to continue to engage in this conversation? Are you looking to decouple? What's down the road for Kate?
So I retire 1 July, and I am committed to this process. I will do whatever I can to help make the transition for the Marine Corps as easy as I can. I am committed to the Marines. I'm committed to ending gender bias. And whatever I can do to help advocate for change, I plan to continue to do.
Well, excellent, Kate. Well, I look forward to seeing more for you. I do appreciate you taking time out this Sunday afternoon to come join us live to discuss this for an hour. It's been a pleasure.
Thanks so much. It's been fun.
Thank you, Kate.
Thanks.
And thank you, everybody, for joining us live. And we look forward to joining you for the next episode of MidRats. And until then, hope everybody has a great Navy and Marine Corps day. Cheers.
Piccadilly, or you'll be to blame for love has fairly drawn. It's a long, long way to Tipperary.